from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. The Trump budget is coming front and center, more spending on the U.S. military. In the Obama years, Republicans and Democrats capped the Pentagon's budget to help rein in deficits. President Trump wants to cut that loose and pay for it out of diplomatic and domestic spending, wants to obliterate ISIS, he said last week. And more this hour on Point in our 100-day spotlight on the Trump administration. We look at the president's new push for military spending and what it means. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Is President Trump on the right track here? Do we need to move big money to the Pentagon after a decade and a half of war in Afghanistan, Iraq, against ISIS? Is paying for it with deep cuts to the State Department and more a good idea? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later in this hour, we will go to the front lines around the Iraqi city of Mosul with a reporter who's been covering the fighting there. President Trump will talk about this and more plenty tonight before Congress, but he's been talking plenty about the military already in the last few days. Here he was at CPAC, Maryland, last Friday, saying he's out to obliterate ISIS.
As part of my pledge to restore safety for the American people, I have also directed the defense community to develop a plan to totally obliterate ISIS.
All right, we'll look at what may be coming there. And here he was talking about funding, big funding for the Pentagon.
We're also putting in a massive budget request for our beloved military. And we will be substantially upgrading all of our military.
Joining me today to look at military spending and more from Washington is Kevin Barron, executive editor of the journal Defense One and national security and military analyst for NBC News and MSNBC. For a link to one of his recent stories, you can go to our website, onpointradio.org. Kevin Barron, thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
$54 billion is the number that we're hearing. Is that a big deal in Pentagon terms? The numbers there are so large, a lot of us don't even know.
You know, $54 billion, you know, let's see. There's the current budget's about $580 billion. The proposed one coming up, a little over $600 billion. So it's a chunk, but it's not, you know, it's not a gigantic increase, if that's what you were hoping for, if you voted for Trump and heard all of his rhetoric.
What about if it comes out of the State Department or out of domestic spending? Is it a big chunk if it comes out there?
Well, if you're the State Department or you're another federal agency, $54 billion is a lot bigger to you. Nothing compares to the DOD budget. So there's a lot to parse out of what's going to go on here if any of this actually gets through Congress, and by most accounts, it won't. But it's not direct, you know, don't think of it as pulling $54 billion directly from the State Department, directly from the mouths of the hungry people around the world. The State Department does a lot of things. The federal government, the non-defense discretionary and entitlement spending does a lot of things. There are a lot more details that would need to come out. This is just it's called the skinny budget. It's a top-line guidance for what the president wants for FY18 to start, you know, at the end of this year. So there's a lot more. There's a lot of ground to cover between now and what actually may happen.
And yet the indication here is that he will pull it out of other departments because as the sequester that we heard about so much about a few years ago under Barack Obama, when everybody was trying to cap the federal budget and spending and deficits, and Republicans and Democrats agreed around this, you say this may not even happen because why? Congress has to agree to pull that cap off the Pentagon to let this roll forward. Do you see the votes for that?
Right. So that's exactly right. The budget caps have been around for a couple of years now. And since the very beginning, since before it was enacted, the national security community has just screamed bloody murder. Please don't do this. This is bad for national security. It's harmful for troop readiness. It's harmful for everything from, you know, being able to maintain the nuclear triad to training pilots.
And you mean the cap is bad for that when they say
the cap, right?
Only this much increase each year and no more.
Right. So the way that – I guess the budget caps made for some interesting bedfellows in Washington. So you, instead of everyone lining up on the usual Republican and Democrat side, when it came to the national security community, Republicans and Democrats on the Armed Services Committees in the House and the Senate were united, saying, don't do this. This is bad for national security. And they screamed Bloody Mary up to McConnell and to Reid and to Pelosi and the rest of them, and they went nowhere. The people in Washington who are in charge of politics ignored the people who are in charge of national security. I see the same thing happening right now. Even though the Republicans want more defense spending, they don't want it at the expense of lots of other things. And the Democrats are the same way. So it may be if you're a hawk and you want more money, great. Here's a proposal for more money. But there's no reason to believe it's going to pass until there's a whole lot of other politics that have nothing to do with national security, that lineup.
Kevin, we pay for active wars, and it's been Afghanistan, Iraq, and more, not out of this budget, but about another budget
right.
That's not even capped and it is very large in itself. So help us understand.
That's right. Well, the Pentagon has like a nice rich uncle called the OCO account, the Overseas Contingency Account, and it's off the books. It doesn't count magically.
Whatever you need, here you go.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly. And we're already separate from this $54 billion part of this larger budget for next year. There's a supplemental request that's due to the White House this week, I think about $30 billion, for the current year's funding. Every year this seems to happen, and the Pentagon has unfunded mandates, or they kind of adjust what they need, whether it's for gas prices or because ISIS comes back, whatever it is. So that has to go through too. So there's a question to me is the question I'm thinking about is even if the White House asks for $54 billion, is it going to come on the books? Is it going to come off the books in this OCO account? Will any of the ISIS war or the global war on terrorism be part of that? So Trump could take a lot away from the State Department that has nothing to do with the ISIS war and throw all that money into this other account. Now Obama and the Pentagon and other Republicans have again on the national security side have tried to get rid of this account to say it's budget tomfoolery. It's being used to pay for regular operations, not necessarily wartime operations. It's a total gimmick. We all know it's a gimmick.
Especially as it goes on year after year.
Yeah. I mean, even if wars go on year after year, this is Washington. I'm a firm believer that money does grow on trees here. They can print it at will. They can say all they want about wanting to be, stewards of the states and of the and of the purse strings when it comes to, the debt or the ceiling and the caps. It's all baloney.
Listen,
they can pass any budget they want, any minute they want to, if the political will is there.
Kevin, here's the thing. We've been at wars, Afghanistan, Iraq, and more now, for a long time, 15-plus years.
Mm-hmm.
Do we have a depleted military? Is that what this is for, to build it back up? Is it just about keeping a campaign promise? Is it to beef up for something new, some big new push, maybe against ISIS?
Well, depleted. So the military likes to complain about readiness. And my answer to that is readiness is in the eye of the beholder. This is the world's largest military. And in one breath, you would have the Secretary of Defense say in every single speech, it's the finest fighting force the world has ever known, right? That was his phrase. Well, you can't be the finest fighting force the world has ever known and be depleted and sucked dry and with horrible equipment that's failing you and unready to fight tonight like you're supposed to. They talk out of both sides of their mouths, and they've been doing this forever too. Look, when that Budget Control Act was being proposed, the first thing the Pentagon put out as a big warning not to do it, they said that if this happens, the Pentagon will not be able to pay for if the sequester is enacted, the 20% cut, the Pentagon won't be able to pay for an entire leg of the nuclear triad, the ICBM missiles.
Go dark.
Which, by the way, a lot of people wanted to – nobody believed it. They cried wolf. So here we are again. Now, what's happening is a lot of opportunism. All of the joint chiefs of all four services have come out with publicly with in our publication, on airways, everywhere else, and told Congress – they're using the opportunity. They know they've got a president who wants to spend money. They know they have some political clout, and they have really a good case to say, "Hey, we've been grinding it out for a lot of years now.
Mm-hmm.
We need money for maintenance. We need money for new ships, new planes. We need to expand our Navy. We need to expand the Air Force. The wars you have us fighting, and the wars you're expecting might happen." Patrolling the South China Sea, checking down Russia, all of these things are way more than was planned a couple years ago, and we're stretched to the limit. We need more. So they're all asking for it. But that's different than saying you're decimated.
You've got generals, retired generals, coming out with a different message here. We've seen this letter that's just come out recently. Mm-hmm. More than 100 generals, 120 plus, warning against budget cuts to the State Department. And it's interesting there. They quote now Defense Secretary James Mattis, something he said while he was commander of U.S. Central Command. He said, if you don't fully fund the State Department, then I need to buy more ammunition. Implication,
yeah, remember,
do diplomacy or do war, but without diplomacy, you're going to be fighting more. And these generals are saying, don't go down this road. Keep the diplomacy up. We need it to put off that fighting, that war.
Right. And there have been about 100 generals every year saying that for the last 20 years. Respect to the generals and respect to the Global Leadership Coalition that puts that statement out. They put a lot of them out every year. But I tweeted before I came on air. Call me when Mitch McConnell and Pelosi say it. Call me when you get the political leaders on the Hill to listen to John McCain and listen to the national security leaders, the Pentagon, the generals who want this money and find the political will to make it happen. A letter from 100 generals, frankly, I think has zero impact whatsoever. A lot of people in the news are excited about it, but I've seen these every year for 20 years.
Well, I mean, here's a good example. You can say zero impact, and I get that. I mean, you can be cynical about the impact, but these have been the leaders of our military force, and they're saying,
yes,
this is not the way to more secure country. This is the way to more fighting.
Yeah, you're absolutely right about that. There's no doubt. I mean, every four-star commander to come out of the Pentagon will be the first to tell you how important the State Department, the development and diplomacy side of the 3 Ds of defense, development, diplomacy. They'll be the first to say why that's important and what they need. But here's the example. I covered Secretary Gates when he was at the Pentagon, and Secretary Clinton was at the State Department. Mm-hmm. And at the time, people were still talking about historically those two agencies don't get along and they fight over money. And would Gates, a Republican, be able to get along with Clinton? Nobody knew how she would be at Secretary of State. And after a couple of years, man, Hillary Clinton had a great reputation at State among the military. She fought for them. She stood up for them. And Gates and her went side by side begging for more State Department money. Gates was offering the National Guard in civilian uniform to do State Department jobs. And with a Democratic Congress and a Democratic White House and an Obama in charge, they couldn't get the money for State Department.
Ain't that America?
Don't expect it to happen with the Republicans and Trump right now.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about President Trump's new push for resources, money, to the military and what that means. Servicemen and women, what do you see out there? Is the military starved for resources? Does cutting back on diplomacy to pay for more arms set us up for more war? As 120 retired generals now warn, as my guest Kevin Barron says, they warned it before. He's executive editor of the journal Defense One and joins us today from Washington. You can join us. What do you think? More spending. Is it a path toward peace through strength or peace because the U.S. is feared? Donald Trump this week, Monday, talking with governors at the White House, saying that this nation no longer knows how to win wars, and he's going to change that, starting with the Middle East.
The Middle East is far worse than it was 16, 17 years ago. There's not even a contest. So we've spent $6 trillion. We have a hornet's nest. It's a mess like you've never seen before. We're nowhere. So we're going to straighten it out.
But the talk about obliterating ISIS, there's a little bit more nuanced message coming from the military itself. Last Thursday at the Brookings Institution, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Joseph Dunford, said any new plan to combat ISIS will not work if it consists of force alone. A military plan alone won't work, he said.
This plan is a political military plan. It is not a military plan. And so far in the development of the plan, we've been completely engaged at every level with the State Department. Secretary Mattis has spoken to Secretary Tillerson. I've spoken to Secretary Tillerson. His representatives have been part of the process. The intelligence community has been representing the process. Treasury Department will be representing the process. So this is a military plan. And as you correctly point out, I think all of us that have participated in these conflicts over the last 15 years realize that anything we do on the ground has to be in the context of political objectives or it's not going to be successful.
Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff there last week. I want to look at what the generals are giving the president in terms of plans for ISIS and keep an eye on this budget number, another $54 billion. Top line, the Trump budget says, for the U.S. military. Kevin Barron, please stand by there in Washington. Also with us from Washington right now is Dakota Wood, senior research fellow for defense programs at the Heritage Foundation, former lieutenant colonel in the Marine Corps. Dakota Wood, thank you very much for joining us.
Tom, great to be with you. Thanks.
And from Washington, Paul Shari joins us, senior fellow in the Defense Strategies and Assessments Program at the Center for New American Security, former Army Ranger. Paul Shari, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom.
Paul, Dakota, I want to come to the numbers, but let's go first to what Donald Trump has been offered by General Mattis, Secretary Mattis, now. In terms of going after ISIS, Dakota Wood, the president talks about obliterating ISIS. Now, we don't have this plan fully public at all yet, but it's been given to the president. What do we know about the general approach that's being advised to President Trump by his military team, Dakota Wood?
Well, I think it's going to be classified, and we won't know the details. But as you just aired, we do know the framework or the approach. And I believe that the Secretary of Defense is going to be presenting or has presented a range of options. Says, Mr. President, this is what your objective is based on the time available and the level of risk you're willing to entertain. You can go little, you can go moderate, you can go big. And there are pros and cons for each one of those. But completely in line with General Dunford, that it has to be a full scope approach, a military, economic leverage, diplomatic initiatives, et cetera. So it's going to be a range of things, and he'll characterize what each of those options mean and then assess some level of risk and level of effort and the materials and resources needed, as well as what the day after looks like. So you could go in big and heavy, mm-hmm. but if you don't stay there for a while and you pull out, does it create a vacuum? You could go in very low, levels of support, but that does that really accomplish what you're trying to achieve? So that kind of informed advice is going to provide a framework. And then in discussion with the National Security Advisor or other, the president will make the appropriate decision.
Paul Shari, the president's talked a lot about, you know, this sort of obliterate theme on ISIS and said he had a plan and he would do it very fast and it would be entirely different. When you look at what President Trump has been offered here, likely in terms of the range of options, is it a different menu than was offered to President Obama or than was wanted by President Obama?
Well, we don't know the details yet, but I think there are a couple things that we can expect will be in those proposals. Two big changes that people have been discussing for the last year, year and a half about ways to accelerate the campaign against ISIS. One is more U.S. troops on the ground. Right now, we're capped at about 5,000 troops in Iraq and 500 in Syria. And those numbers are pretty low, and more advisors on the ground could accelerate those offensives. And then the other component of this is allowing U.S. advisors to move closer to the front lines to assist Iraqi and Syrian forces closer to the actual fighting. And that allows a tighter integration of those local troops who are really doing the house-to-house fighting with U.S. air power and artillery and intelligence assets that can support them. I don't think we're going to see some kind of return to the larger days during the Iraq War where the U.S. is really taking the burden on themselves. It doesn't make sense. We've been there. We did that. The problem is then you own the problem, and it's very difficult to transition. And so I don't think we're likely to see a return to tens of thousands of troops, but we may see several thousand more on the ground.
Paul, we're going to go later in this hour to Mosul to get the latest news from there on the offensive. U.S. advisors, along with Iraqi troops, trying to take that back from ISIS, and they've had some success, but there's a lot still to be done. At the 5,000 cap, can you describe what is the U.S. military engagement against ISIS now, as things stand now?
So the U.S. is in a supporting role for Iraqi forces. So the U.S. is providing them intelligence, from overhead assets like drones. It's providing air power in the form of airstrikes, artillery strikes. One of the things that the Obama administration has held back on is having U.S. advisors embedded with the Iraqi and Syrian forces as they're doing the fighting. And that allows a much tighter integration, and that allows the U.S. Air power and intelligence to then be more effective as they're going forward.
Dakota Wood, if the president's giving a range of options here and he decides to go heavy, to go big, what might that even look like?
Well, that option would include most likely Army brigade combat teams. So as we've just been talking and laying out, these are large formations of 4,000 to 5,000 soldiers with all the support, logistics, artillery, medical, engineers. I mean, these are the big kinds of maneuver elements that were used in Iraq. Mm-hmm. But I think everybody that I've heard is not recommending that approach. So okay. I agree with Paul on that, that it introduces too many additional problems. But that would be – I mean, that's an option. You know, it's something that you could do, but it carries costs and consequences along with it.
Kevin, this president likes to say he's delivered on his promises, and he continues to talk about obliterating ISIS. So given the likely range of options on the menu here, are there steps that he could take that would show some kind of dramatic setback for ISIS in a relatively short period of time? We know he likes to turn to the country and say, look, see, I did it.
Yeah, I mean, remember, he didn't say obliterate ISIS. He said totally obliterate ISIS.
Oh,
I mean,
well, that's totally different.
Look, it's ridiculous. A couple of things going back to kind of, to what Paul was saying also. So there's been a lot of fighting going on, and what's happened in Iraq and Syria has really changed in the last 6 to 9 months. So it's almost irrelevant to think about what Obama had asked for a while back. It was already changing. The entire last year of 2016, Obama and Secretary Carter were out there saying they already were accelerating the fight and helping the Iraqis push forward. They've taken back tons of territory. I don't know what the percentage is now, 80%, something like that. They're already – half of Mosul is taken. They're already pushing into West Mosul. So think about what's left to do in Iraq. The United States doesn't need another 10,000 ground troops to take the rest of Mosul.
If you put brigades in there, what would they even go after?
Right. They do need some things. So General Votel has been out there in the past week, and he said, you know, not just in Iraq, but also there's two separate fights. There's Iraq, and then there's Syria and the fight for Raqqa to come.
Yep.
Mosul needed an assault force to go in and take the city, and that's what's happening, and that's the Iraqis in the lead, but with a lot of American special operators also on the ground, they're at full capacity and at full pace, according to General Thomas.
Yeah.
Don't think of Americans as sitting back doing nothing. Americans are fighting.
Yep.
This week, General Townsend said Americans are now closer to the front lines, and they're right in the thick of it, and they're there because of an order that President Obama signed on December 26th. We just learned about that this past weekend.
Okay.
So Obama himself, right before he left office, mm-hmm. Loosened the reins. That's just in Iraq. Up in Syria, a different story. You've got the Syrian Defense Force, the SDF, who I think are showing to be – they were capable to get to a certain point, and now they need a lot more help. Votel just went out there saying they need bigger guns. They need bigger ground support.
You mean Assad's forces?
No, I mean the rebels that the Americans are supporting,
okay.
The SDF,
Not
the Syrian army. The Syrian Defense Force is the coalition.
Okay.
And that fight is being staged to go. The reason that hasn't happened yet, again, according to U.S. officials last fall, said they didn't want to do these two things at the same time. They didn't have – because the U.S. military didn't have the enabling force to help support everything at once, at least if they didn't have to. So they've taken their time on purpose. The United States wants – the Iraqis to be in the lead, like Paul said. They don't want to own this battle. They don't want to own the politics afterward. They don't want to send a bunch of Marines in there to be sitting ducks in Raqqa after they take the town if there's nobody to give it over to. So this goes back to Obama's, you know, the Obama doctrine. He made a decision to say there's no reason to send Americans to fight and die urgently when it's not a existential threat to the United States. We can sit back and give 2 years of time or however long it takes.
Mm-hmm.
It depends how much patience you have to get it right. That's the big question now. How much patience will Trump have to listen to his generals? Because I think the other guys are right here. What they're going to offer is not that much different than what we're seeing. It's just the next iteration that you would have expected anyway.
Totally obliterate does not sound like patience. I want to go to our listeners. Kevin, Dakota Wood, Paul Shari, please stand by. Katie in Baltimore, you're on the air. Thank you for calling, Katie.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just had a comment. I mean, I think the idea of, like, totally obliterating ISIS is pretty ridiculous, but, like, hypothetically, if he could do something to do that, wouldn't another giant terrorist group just kind of, like, pop up in the place of that? And I just don't see, like, increasing our military spending, which is already over the top, as being anything effective towards that. I'm also kind of curious, do you think that there could be a draft within President Trump's term because he's so gung-ho about, like, big military?
I'll ask Katie. Let me hold that thought and get one more right here from Dayton, Ohio, and we'll put it all on the table. Katie, thanks. Russ in Dayton, Ohio. Russ, you're on.
Hello, Tom. Tom, why don't we just put 20,000 troops on the ground and just take care of this issue? It's not a country. It's a terrorist organization. And, well, I love my military, and they're fully capable of doing this. And
but you know, we put a lot more than 20,000 troops on the ground in Iraq, and that wasn't exactly an easy deal, right? That was years and ended up very messy. I mean, do you think numbers alone are going to do this, Russ?
I think in this case, yes. It again, it's not a country. It's an organization, a business.
Yeah, I hear you. Of course, it's still people, and they still have weapons, and they still have ideas. Let us look at both of those. Russ, I appreciate your call. Paul Shari, Katie's skeptical of the obliterate. I mean, even if you do, is it a whack-a-mole scene where the same dynamics driving ISIS lead others, terrorists, if you will, to pop up somewhere else? Russ says just bring the hammer down heavy and be done with this.
Well, we certainly could go in. It's a valid question. The U.S. military could go in and we could take Mosul and we could take Raqqa. The problem is then what comes next? Because we've seen what that looks like. We controlled Mosul just a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
We had U.S. troops walk in the streets of Mosul patrolling it. And then getting out is really hard because it's right. They're not a country. ISIS, Al-Qaeda, it's a network. They can disperse, they can hide, and they can come back as soon as you leave. So it's actually not taking the city that's hard. It's the politics. It's the politics of what comes next, who controls it. And that's, I think, Tom, an important disconnect between what the president has said he wants to do with ISIS and the budget he's putting forward.
What do you
which
mean?
Which has a plus up for the military, but is cutting diplomacy. And that's going to be an important component of defeating ISIS, too.
If the president says to the military, look, I have promised and I want a scalp, you know, I want a scene of obliteration that I can show the American people. Is that out there for him, Paul? And would that make any sense? Is there one just always wonders with politicians, is there a piece of theater that could be put forward as, okay, you know, job done?
I mean, we've been doing that for over 15 years now since 9/11. We've been killing top senior leaders in ISIS and Al-Qaeda. We killed bin Laden. And these organizations are very resilient. They keep existing. And so really, if you want to actually get rid of this safe space, you've got to put the politics in place to have sustainable security. That's really hard. It takes time. It takes an enduring commitment. It takes patience. And it's just not going to happen quickly. And it's not going to happen without diplomacy. That's a big component of it,
Dakota Wood, the president says we don't win anymore. Look at the Middle East over the last, decade or two. Is there a real alternative here to grinding it out, the sort of Obama-style long game?
Yeah, he's expressing a frustration that I think many Americans have, and that we have invested both treasure and lives, and yet we don't have the desired outcomes after 15 years. And so then it begs the question of why is that? You know, were we half-stepping? It's kind of like going to the doctor when you've got an illness and he prescribes medication and you only take half of it. You know, don't be surprised if you don't get the good outcome. So a lot of the criticism of the Obama administration is that it was a bare minimum use in Afghanistan, Iraq, and even in Syria out of fear of getting further entangled in a very messy situation. But those half-steps can actually worsen the problem. So to the earlier question about could we obliterate Islamic State, absolutely, if you've defined the problem being a cohesive pseudo-state type of organization with the ability to take and hold ground. So, you know, Al-Qaeda or other terror organizations aren't at that level, you know, of cohesion and size and the ability to control states. So you could get rid of that component. Now, you still have this residual terror group that can inspire attacks like Orlando and San Bernardino and do, you know, bombs in Paris and Munich and other places, right? So there will always be that problem. You know, it's a multilateral, a multifunctional approach to that with diplomacy and trying to create environments that are hostile to terror groups. But you could get rid of the Islamic State as a proto-state.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about President Trump's new push of resources, money, to the military. Big top-line increase in the Trump budget. He'll talk about that tonight before Congress. We'll see what that means on spending, what it may mean also for ISIS. He said on the campaign trail, 30 days, he'll have a plan for the country to obliterate. Still talking about obliterating ISIS, and the Pentagon has begun to lay out options for the president, looking at those as well. Kevin Barron is with us this hour, executive editor at Defense One. Dakota Wood is here from Defense Programs at the Heritage Foundation. Paul Shari from Defense Strategies and Assessments Program at the Center for a New American Security. Both former former Army Ranger, former Lieutenant Colonel in the Marine Corps, Dakota Wood. You can join us this hour. What do you see coming with ISIS and the military and military spending under President Trump? We're going to get the latest from Mosul before this hour is up. We've got a lot of callers for the three of you. Rob in Iowa City. Rob, you're on the air. Thank you very much for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. So I just wanted to make a comment. I mean, the whole point for this increased funding is that the claim that the military is depleted, but in terms of discretionary spending, we dedicate as much to the military as we do to every other category combined. This is 8.5 times what we spend on education, 20 times what we spend on Social Security or unemployment. We've seen the base budget for the DOD increase by 31% between 2000 and 2014, according to the Congressional Budget Office. We've seen multiple examples of wasteful, inefficient military spending in the order of trillions of dollars over this period of time. And President Trump wants $54 billion additional dollars. I mean, we can be proud of the military, and we should be. It is the finest fighting force in the world, but it needs to be more efficient. It's a budget priority, but it's not the only priority. So the take-home point here is that the military is not depleted. That's a lie. Believe me.
Rob, let us pick it straight up. Paul Shari, how about it? Depleted, and then lots of question marks Rob puts out there. And what about the cost of this hike in spending on the military to everything else that it might come out of?
Well, there's no question that military readiness has been hurt significantly by the cuts from the Budget Control Act. We've seen deferrals in necessary maintenance and training. We've already begun to see accidents in aviation as a cause of that. But I think the caller's also right that there is a lot of waste in the Pentagon. And, you know, if President Trump really wants to make a lasting impact on the military, that's probably one of the best places that he can do so, which is taking his business acumen, taking his eye from the private sector to really start cutting this government bloat and waste in the Pentagon. And there are places to do that. It's going to require work from Congress, things like another round of base closures that's really just now necessary overhead. There's excess overhead and command structure within the Department of Defense that numerous secretaries of defense have tried to cut and the bureaucracies push back. So there's a lot of room to do that too and then reinvest that money in other priorities.
Kevin, do you see any indication of this administration going harder after waste in the military and for efficiency compared to others?
Yeah, they might. And, you know, you could look at Trump right away diving into the Air Force One and F-35 contracts. But, you know,
what Paul's saying is too expensive. Yeah.
Right. But look, there's big ticket, you know, there's big ticket hardware, and then there's the operations, and then there's the actual national security strategy that is tasked to the military. So for all the savings in the world, first of all, I think Congress is never going to pass another BRAC, so forget it. I think it's money you have to eat. I think the savings you can get from, you know, better acquisition reform, that's all great and fine, but that's not going to pay for what the Navy is saying or what the Air Force is saying. They want to increase the number of ships by tens and you know, orders of magnitude more. Tom, if I could go back to just earlier, a couple of things that were said about Trump and winning. I think people should know this, right, with the speech coming up. Trump just went to Tampa last month for his first time and had a closed-door meeting with General Votel, the head of CENTCOM, and General Thomas, the head of Special Operations Command. Mm-hmm. Last week, General Thomas was up here. We asked him, how did the meeting go? What did Trump say? He said Trump asked him, define winning. What would winning look like? And the generals walked
against ISIS,
that.
Kevin, or what?
Against ISIS. Okay. He said, how can we win? We don't win. He asked specifically. Trump is really fixated on winning.
It's a good question. I mean, what would winning look like?
Well, we asked General Thomas, and just like every general for the last 5, 6, 8 years, They don't talk about winning. They get what – this is a war on terror. That's a 30-year, 100-year, a generational thing. They don't talk about winning. So we know – we can assume what the details that they've told Trump, that's not really how it works, buddy. This is – Mr. President, this is what we think. And yet yesterday Trump gets back on the microphone and says, oh, we don't win wars anymore. We got to win.
And he talks so total obliteration.
Yeah, he's not listening to the generals in that sense, but will he? So how does that translate to this budget and to what generals say they need and want? The generals may go up there and say, here's exactly what we need. He may give it to them. But when it comes to this bigger strategy, again, General Votel himself at CNAS, at Paul's organization, just wrote a big paper saying, well, we need to do more to fight the virtual caliphate. Not the ground war is fine. It's taken care of. It's almost fait accompli. What are you going to do after the previous caller's question about these pop-up organizations everywhere else? Because after Iraq and Syria, you got Libya, you got Yemen, you got everywhere else.
Yeah.
You're not going to win these conflicts until you put down the ideology and replace it with another completely different future society for the entire region. That's not a question about winning. But that's what President Trump asked. Mm-hmm. He went to CENTCOM and he went to SOCOM and he goes, what does winning look like? That's what I want. So I'm waiting to hear how all these – everyone keeps talking about how are you going to square these circles. How is his budget and all the big asks going to square with that desire to just win and get that big moment that you were asking about before?
Dakota Wood, of course, we have a big political player, Steve Bannon, on the National Security Council now. So it may be a view that's not exactly a military view that has sway here. I mean, what do you feel this president communicating to the military? You are experienced. You know what you're doing out there. Tell me how to go. Or I want a big gesture, and here's how it's going to have to look. You bring it to me.
Well, I wouldn't speculate what goes on in the private deliberations in the White House. We don't have access to that. We don't know what those specific conversations are. But I do know that the people involved, especially on the military side, are career students of war between states in all of its forms, from very irregular to counterterrorism operations to big war, Korea, Vietnam, etc., World War II. And they understand the complexity of these kinds of issues, and that military action is a component of political action. It's the relationship between nation states and between states and non-state entities. So all of that understanding and knowledge is going into those discussions, and it's right that economic advisors, political advisors, both domestic and foreign, and military advisors are feeding into that discussion. And so I'm fully confident that the president will be given a good plate of options, the pros and cons, the implications, and then from that, what is the strategic objective to be attained? What is the cost and resources and time and material necessary to accomplish that? And then he makes a decision based on the political context of other things he's trying to get done within the country.
We've got the money he's asked for. We've got some kind of menu of options he's asked for. Do you see a big change coming, Paul, in ISIS strategy?
I think the administration will sell it as a big change, but it'll probably be modest. It'll probably be more consistent with what we've been doing, but it'll probably be the right steps that we need to go forward. The challenge is going to be integrating with that, with the diplomatic side of things, which is also critical to having a long-term success against ISIS.
Particularly as we've got a lot of retired generals now warning, if you take resources out of the diplomatic side. It's been very interesting today on both the money side and the ISIS side, and I'm grateful to all three of you for looking into it with us. Paul Sherry at the Center for New American Security. Paul, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Dakota Wood at the Heritage Foundation, thank you very much for joining us, Dakota.
Enjoyed it. Thanks for having us on.
You bet. And Kevin Barron, Executive Editor at Defense One. Always good to have you, Kevin. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you.
In a moment, we hear from the front lines of the Iraqi city of Mosul. This is On Point. Iraqi government forces are closing in on ISIS forces in the northern city of Mosul, the last remaining physical ISIS stronghold in Iraq. American military advisors are there with them, advising and calling in U.S. airstrikes. CNN's senior international correspondent Ben Wiedemann has been covering ISIS for a couple of years now and has been traveling to the front lines around Mosul for the past week. He was there today. He's now safely back in the city of Erbil. But here he was over the weekend filing from the front lines around Mosul. Here is CNN's Ben Wiedemann.
The bombardment of western Mosul is intense and steady. Iraqis flying Russian-made Mi-35 attack helicopters blasted ISIS targets inside the city.
Ben Wiedemann now, away from Mosul and in Erbil, and joining us. Ben, thank you very much for being with us.
Anytime, Tom.
So what is the state of the operation against ISIS in Mosul, at least as recently as you've seen it, which is very recent indeed, Ben?
Well, what we saw is that Iraqi forces have entered sort of the southern sector of the western part of the city, and the level of bombardment is fairly intense. The fighting is intense as well. I mean, we were there this afternoon. We saw B-52s flying overhead, F-16s, helicopters, drones. There really is a lot of firepower being poured into the city. But, of course, you know, the situation is such that, you know, you've got hundreds of thousands of civilians caught in the middle, and we were at one field hospital where Iraqi and American doctors are working together, and a steady stream of wounded coming in, and it's a hard fight. In fact, we were speaking to one Iraqi commander with the federal police, which basically plays a combat role in Mosul, and he was telling us when the operation to retake Mosul began back in October, they had 130 men. Now they're down to 27, the rest either killed or wounded. So it's an intense fight, and it goes on with an intensity, at least in the western side, that we didn't see in the east.
Ben, step back, if you will, and describe the sort of overall layout of Mosul. Who's coming from where? Where are the strongholds? What's been taken? What remains? What's the topography here?
Well, the city is divided roughly in two by the Tigris River. The eastern side is now completely liberated. However, because of the presence of sleeper cells, security, there's basically a security vacuum. The Iraqis don't really have enough forces to secure those areas that they've liberated. So in the east, that's the problem. In the west, you have, according to the United Nations, as many as somewhere between 750 to 800,000 civilians caught in the middle. Now, at the moment, the push is on the southern part of western Mosul, which is the least populated. So if you look at the map of the progress made by Iraqi forces in the week or so, now I think we're 9 days into the offensive, it looks impressive. But really, they are taking ground that is less. It's sparsely populated. They haven't really gotten to the real hard areas. For instance, the old city of Mosul, which has got narrow streets, which are very difficult for Iraqi armor to negotiate. And, of course, we know that we've already seen that ISIS has dug a complex network of tunnels in the western part of the city. In other areas, what they do is, in a block of buildings, they'll knock holes between the buildings so that they can move back and forth undetected by drones overhead. So really we're at the opening stages of what could be a battle that, like the one in East, the East, it took them 3 months to retake the East, and this battle could be even harder in the West. So it's going to be a long, hard fight. And the presence of so many civilians in the middle really makes it even more complicated.
Ben, you described the casualties taken in just one unit there. We've heard pretty astonishing numbers overall. Iraqi forces with an attrition rate, a loss rate of something like 50%. That's very high. Do the Iraqi forces have the depth to keep this offensive up all the way to victory?
Well, that's a question many people are asking, because there's specific forces that are being used for the real hard fight. It's the what's known as the Golden Brigade. That was a U.S. trained and equipped elite force. They've got an attrition rate of about 50% at this point. Now you have other units that are have a lot of experience. They fought in Ramadi and Fallujah and Tikrit, and they're exhausted. They're worn out from just constantly bearing the burden of this war. Now, then you have like the federal police. They're also involved in the fight, and they are also really part of this force that's really taking the brunt of the fighting. Then you have the great mass of the Iraqi army, which is politicized and relatively poorly trained. They are the ones who go in afterwards and secure those areas that the other forces have gone in. And what I've seen in the past is that oftentimes the elite forces will go in, drive ISIS out, and then the army comes in and they start to loot. They start to abuse the local populations. And that's one of the big problems in this war. So you have a very battle-hardened force, but it's dwindling as this war goes on simply from attrition.
Ben, when you're out, we've just got a minute here, when you're out near the front lines, do you see U.S. special operators there? What about the U.S. Boots on the ground role here?
Yeah, we saw them up close and personal just the other day. It was a group of spotters who were just about a mile from the front line. They were calling in helicopter airstrikes. They weren't very talkative. They didn't give us any details about their unit or anything like that. But they're very much close to the front, and it appears they're taking a more forward role when it comes to everything they do there. And this is what we've also understood from the Pentagon, that the plan is for them to be closer and closer to the action.
Are they guns out and in the fight, or is it all about spotting and bringing in air power?
Well, they're armed for the fight, and one of them had a very big sniper rifle. He was using it more to just spot potential targets, but they, if need be, they would be ready for action. And we have heard from the coalition spokesman in Baghdad that there have been many instances where U.S. forces were wounded. Some of them had to be medevaced. So
Ben, we're up against it right there.
To get hurt.
We really appreciate your being with us today. Ben Wiedemann, senior international correspondent for CNN, just out of Mosul. Ben, stay safe and thank you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.